The numbers of housewives who followed these programs is awesome. The shows were always very carefully scripted, some by a lady named Elaine Carrington. And nearly half the major soaps came from the office of Frank Hummert and his beautiful wife, Anne. To name a few, The Romance of Helen Trent, Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle, David Harum, Our Gal Sunday, Stella Dallas, John's Other Wife, Mary Noble, and Life Can Be Beautiful. Mrs. Hummert herself admits that a winning formula was found.
Mr. Hummert and I together started what I think is the first daytime serial. It was just plain Bill. And that embodied, as every serial we had on the air, as every show we had on the air did, the idea that it had to incorporate a fundamental of American life. The parent was less well-educated than the child. This was the case of a barber in the heartland of America. We called it Hartville. Marvelous philosophical sort of man who'd had very little education. In his youth, married a socially prominent girl. She died when their daughter was born. And now, in the first scene, the daughter, Nancy, is coming home. And the question is, having been educated in Eastern schools with all the polish of the East, is she going to be too good for her father? Well, she wasn't, and usually her father was much smarter in his deductions about life than the daughter was or anybody around. And that show became tremendously successful in the terrible parts of the depth of the Depression. Nobody had any money to spend on anything. And Roxy Theater had thousands of seats. And the man said, how would you like to put just plain Bill on the stage? And we'll say that if the people bring a toothpaste carton, they can get in. Well, they had so many people go to the Roxy, they had to have mounted police around the place. Mothers, husbands, fathers, there with children, everybody to see Bill and his daughter Nancy. That first terrific impact on the lives of people of radio was visible to us.
Now we present once again Mary Noble, backstage wife, the story of a little Iowa girl who married one of America's most handsome actors, Larry Noble, matinee idol of a million other women. The story of what it means to be the wife of a famous star.
We were part of what they called the Hummert stable. There was usually conflict of all kinds, or it seems to me that at one time or another, in every single show, someone lost their memory, or someone was indicted for murder.
This is Fran Carlin, who played an extraordinary number of radio roles. Remember her voice from Our Gal Sunday?
Well, Our Gal Sunday, who was married to England's richest and handsomest lord, left on the doorstep by two old miners. Can she find happiness married to, oh dear, it's been so long, Lord Henry Brinthrop. And Our Gal was always in terrible trouble, it seemed to me, and I, her best friend and next-door neighbor. And, of course, for identification purposes, the daytime soap consisted of repetition, our gal would say. And Irene, now I know you're my next-door neighbor and best friend, so it was, you always had this to identify you. On Backstage Wife, when I was doing one of the heavies on it, and I was always locking somebody into the eight-sided octagonal room.
What a strange, strange person Jean is. This sudden maturity, this perception. Yes, and this amazing insight into his father. It's wonderful. But it's also frightening.
This is a page from a new chapter in the lives of Anne Malone and her husband, Jerry. We'll return to the Malones in a moment. Now, in Three Oaks, Bess Pringle is chatting with her daughter-in-law, Elaine. And Elaine is saying...
Oh, why, that reminds me. Do you have any ideas for varying fish fillets?
Well, let me see. You might try coating them with flour and dip them in ketchup and breadcrumbs.
Uh-huh.
Then you pan fry them in Crisco. We like them that way.
Good old Crisco. I don't know how I keep house without it. I save money by buying the 3-pound size, too.
Well, I don't think any shortening, regardless of price or type, can beat Crisco for frying.
The Pringles were a family created especially to talk about the sponsor's product, and I might add that the advertising was endless. A 3-minute pitch was standard, and contests were perennial favorites. Just send your name and address with the last line of this jingle. Stop searching from morning till night for a soap that will wash clothes more bright. Throw out one and all, get high-test Oxidol, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And now... back to our story.
Now, of course, we had absolute, incredible censorship then. You couldn't use a word like damn, that was prohibited. You couldn't possibly have suggested that anyone was having an illegitimate child. As a matter of fact, we had one on called Backstage Wife, 4 o'clock, right ahead of Stella Dallas, 4 in the afternoon. And that was the story of a girl who married a star who was the dream sweetheart of a million other women. So she was always terribly jealous. So one day she believed that an actress with whom he was playing was in love with him, and he was, Larry, the husband, was in love with the actress. So we had a scene that gave the impression the two had gone into a room alone together. And I got in my office the next day. The Legion of Decency was there. Of course, he was absolutely innocent. They always had to be innocent. You couldn't have anything else happen then.
Please sit down, both of you. I want to talk to you.
Carl and Jerry look at Anne dumbfounded, for she has such a grim, determined expression on her face. But what, Jerry wonders, could Anne possibly know about Phyllis's strange behavior that he and Carl don't?
I have to at least mention 2 other shows. Remember One Man's Family, a nighttime soap opera, and Vic and Sade, a domestic comedy that reflected just about every nuance of small-town mannerisms of the innocent years, pre-Pearl Harbor.
Now, back again. We go to the small house, halfway up in the next block. This time, our scene opens on the front porch. We find Vic, Sade, and Uncle Fletcher seated here and there, awaiting the arrival of Mrs. Keller.
I'm going to show her I am a violent man.
She knows you're no violent man.
She don't know it for sure.
Oh.
I heard the kitchen screen door open.
Miss Keller, by George.
Oh, she wouldn't be coming in the back way. I expect it's Rush.
Oh, where'd you go, by the way? I thought he was still around under some foot.
Oh, he was on it off a few minutes ago. Never even noticed him leave myself.
My landlady, Miss Keller, don't know for sure.
Don't let me give the impression that soaps were the only style of daytime radio. There were household hints, cooking shows, shows on how to balance your budget, in case you had a budget back in 1933 or 34, and hundreds of little talks on every conceivable subject the sponsors thought would interest women. Everything except news and world affairs and stuff that mattered, of course. We now bring you, just as we did in 1938, the Norge Musical Kitchen.
A meeting of the Norge Kitchen Committee, transcribed for American Housewives from coast to coast, presents an all-star program with Julia Sanderson and Frank Crummett as our special shining lights for today, together with our regular supporting stars, the Norge Rollator Refrigerator, Norge Concentrator Range, Norge Auto-Built Washer, Norge Duotrol Ironer, Norge Fine Air Furnace, and a host of other home modernizing appliances. And here is your hostess and homemaking expert, the queen of the Norge kitchen, Miss Mary Modern.
We've gathered right here in our Norge model kitchen to hear some bits of music and to see if we can't trade a few useful household hints from our question box. But first of all, let's open our meeting with a song. How about it, Miss Sanderson?
All right. How would you like, in your own little innocent way?
Well, we'd rather have it, Miss Sanderson, in your own little innocent way.
Thank you.
Thank you, though. Hello, nephews, nieces, too, mothers and daddies. How are you? This is Uncle Don, all set to go. With a meeting on the radio, we'll start off with a little song. To learn the words will not take long, for they're as easy can be. Come on now and sing with me. Hibbity gits, hotsa, ring-bo-ree, Simonia, skibbity, high-low-dee, honey-co-doke with an alley-kazan. Sing this song with your Uncle Dan.
Radio of the 1930s had something for everybody. The first kids' shows were the bedtime story type and all very clean-cut. In the world of Uncle Don, the worst villains were the thumbsuckers and the nail-biters. This is Jack Popoli, chief engineer of WOR during the 20s.
We had the original children's program there called Rainbow House with Big Brother Bob Emery. And the Rainbow House was programmed specifically for the children on Saturday morning. Prior to Uncle Don, we had a Bill McNeary from the New York Sunday Call back in 1923, in which, where he announced the birthdays, he would hang a star out for every child with their name on it. And he was hanging a star in the sky for Mary Jones, who is today 3 years old. Then in addition to that, we had Uncle Don. And Uncle Don, as programming started to expand, had his program every evening between 6:30 and 7 o'clock, which is today prime time news broadcasting.
In Chicago, in 1932, N.W. Ayer and the Kellogg Company were looking for a similar show. A young person who would sing and play nursery rhymes, and their choice was the singing lady, Irene Wicker.
Somebody suggested, I think it was Erna Phillips, why don't you just make a little story about Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh and put a few songs in it. Halfway up the stairs is a stair where I sit, etc. So I did it and won the audition. And they said, now you have to write it. So it turned out I had to start the next week. And I used to have to do it 3 times a day because the old Mr. Kellogg didn't like having records made. Those were the old days of radio when everything was beautifully informal.
Once upon a time, long, long ago, in the land of make-believe, there was a rich, rather strange old lady whose name was Zauberin. She had everything in the world she wanted, except a daughter. And the only person she really loved was Rapunzel, the beautiful young daughter of her gardener and his wife. And there was one thing about her different from anyone else. Her hair, yellow as gold and so long, it had to be looped up ever so many times to keep from trailing on the ground. The day of it was over.
This number is from the Amateur Hour, circa 1937. Radio had some really talented kids and a few monsters. There was Baby Rosemarie, the Moylan sisters, Ron Liss, who created the role of Batman's friend and constant companion Robin, Bobby and Billy Mork, Billy and Florence Hallop. Remember the DeMarco sisters?
You got to give a little, take a little, and let your poor heart break a little. That's the story of, that's the glory of love. You got to laugh a little, cry a little, before the clouds roll by a little. That's the story of, that's the glory of love.
In 1927 came the Horn and Hard Arts Children's Hour, created in Philadelphia by Stan Lee Broza. It stayed on the air 31 years with the same sponsor. And that's some kind of record.
Now, on with the Children's Hour.
Hello again,
sorry for you. And when you're hungry, then we welcome you to Barney Barbucks too. The finest foods and lowest price, coming often, it's our advice. Now on with the show and the songs of the new Stanley Rose.
I was the host of the show, which was a variety show, with youngsters from 4 to 16 years of age. Each show had a theme. It was written and produced by my wife, Esther Broza. It was broadcast each Sunday morning from 11:30 to 12:30, with a regular cast of about 50, with new faces introduced once a month. Some of these were Ezra Stone, who became Henry Aldrich of the famous Aldrich family on network radio. Then there were Kitty Callan, Eddie Fisher, Frankie Avalon, Bobby Rydell, and Sheridan. Roddy McDowell, as a boy, made his first appearance on the show. The format was a variety show, naturally, but we had sketches, blackouts, musical numbers, dancing numbers, and a theme. We also did little condensed versions of famous musicals and operettas, and with the youngsters, like a scene from The Student Prince.
And then there was a wonderfully imaginative show and a great favorite, Let's Pretend, created, written, and directed by Nyla Mack. That was on Saturdays for years, just before lunch.
We have it every day. We sing this song, it will make us strong, and it makes us shout, hooray! It's good for growing babies and grown-ups too, to eat. For all the family's breakfast, you can be Cream of Wheat.
Cream of Wheat, the great American family cereal, presents Let's Pretend.
Uncle Bill, with all these sounds and noises in today's story, isn't it about time for us to play our sound effects game again?
That's the very idea I had, Sybil. Once upon a time, there was a young man named Jimmy Jones who hated to get up in the morning. Even his old dog Spike couldn't get him up, not even by barking his head off like this. Well, sir, do you know what finally did the trick? That's right. One of the players was Sybil Trent, who started on the air as Baby Sybil when she was only 3 1/2.
In 1935, I think it was, I was invited to audition for Let's Pretend. Nyla Mack was the director, the producer, and the writer of Let's Pretend. And she was a former actress. She had appeared with Nazimova, and she was really a very wonderful lady. It was on for 24 years. I was on it for 20. And what was wonderful about being on Let's Pretend, we were a sort of a stock company of people, same people every week. And we grew up on the show. After all, it was on for 20 years. And so we got to play just about every part because she didn't believe in a star system. And so one week I'd be the fairy princess, and the next week I might be one of the little fairies or a scullery maid or something, you know. And we were not sponsored for many years. We were a sustaining program because Nyla Mack just wouldn't accept any sponsor. She felt it was a very special kind of show and that you should have something that appealed just to children. So I guess we were sponsored about 13 years by the Cream of Wheat Company. And I used to sing the commercials about Cream of Wheat is so good to eat.
It's Adventure Time with Orphan Annie. Done justice to the kids' adventure shows. I think all the major comic strip characters did a stint on radio.
starting with The Gumps, with Agnes Moorehead playing Min Gump. There was Captain Midnight. Night, I Love a Mystery, Don Winslow of the Navy. And here's one for you trivia lovers.
The Adventures of Frank Merriwell. Tonight's episode, Frank Confesses in the Dark. Well, let's go back to Frank Merriwell's last adventure and see where we left it. In a bad spot, I'm afraid. You see, Frank has always been a model student at Fardale Academy, but the last we heard of him, he was playing poker with a bunch of cadets who call themselves the Black Sheep. Now, playing poker isn't a very healthy pastime for young military students, is it? But this is the way it happened, how Frank Merriwell happened to get in with this crowd.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the bran. Won't you try Wheaties? For wheat is the best food of man. They're crispy, they're crunchy, the whole year through. Jack Anto never tires of them, and neither will you. So just buy Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land. Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them how we stand. Ever shall our team be champions. Blow throughout the land. Boola boola, boola boola, boola boola, boola boo.
It was on for 18 years, from 1933. It was criticized, laughed at, and parodied as Jack Headstrong, the All-American Dope. Nevertheless, the kids adored it. And it sold blizzards of Wheaties and warehouses of premiums too numerous to mention. Here's the style.
Yesterday, after the Pelican caught fire, Jack offered to take a line across the packed ice floes so that Captain Hands and his men might be rescued with a breeches boy. Here we are on deck. Jack has just started across.
He's starting to wave his arms and shout. Some of the men are running to the rails. They're looking this way and pointing. They've seen Jack at last. Hands must have spotted him.
Good.
Oh, they're spotted. Good for him. I'm so glad.
It's about time. Now watch close, Northrop. Hans will know what we're doing. You can soon tell whether they've got tackle or not.
He's shouting some kind of order. The men are running from the bow. They're going to do something, all right.
They'll save a lot of time if they can get ready.
Aye, and they'll know it.
They've got tackle, all right. They're running to the...
This is Henry Morgan. On the next two sides, George Hamilton Coombs will play for you a few classics in sports, some musical shows, and begin the long story that culminated in World War II. But in the meantime, here is what may be old radio's campiest moment. The Grand March of the Breakfast of Champions.
There is Feeling, Feeling Carnera out for that thing that'll end the fight if it's possible. And then Carnera put over a straight left to the face again, and another...
That is Graham McNamee, NBC's Mr. Radio, of the 1930s at the Bear-Carnera fight in June of 1934.
Talk about nerve! He'll fight till he's dead, that man! He'll fight till nothing can stop him! Carnera is almost...
I'm George Hamilton Coombs. I've been in radio for three decades, give or take a little. Things that we take for granted today in radio had beginnings that are hard to believe. That sportscast, for example, reminds me that in the 1930s, the world of sports did not exactly welcome broadcasting. If people can hear a game at home, they argued, who'll come to the ballpark? Furthermore, no one saw baseball as a sponsored show. So covering a ball game, particularly an out-of-town ball game, was hardly a big deal. This is Red Barber.
Why, nobody even dreamed of traveling one or two announcers and an engineer and paying AT&T line charges to do live baseball games out of town. There wasn't that money. It wasn't even considered. So what you did, you paid Western Union $25 for a service they called Paragraph 1. And they had experienced sending operators at each ballpark in the major leagues. And they would send to everybody who subscribed to their service. And it could be one station, it could be 100 stations, it could be 50 bars, it could be clubs. Whoever wanted to buy the service, all they had to do was tell Western Union, and the whole thing went on Morse code, dots and dashes. And everybody who bought the service had a receiving operator. Well, I didn't know a dot from a dash, and I still don't. I never did want to know. But the receiving operator used to take down, used to put it on a typewriter, and I would stand and look over his shoulder. And it came in a skeleton form, a code. For example, Western Union would send you the weather conditions a half an hour before the game was to start and send you the batting orders. Then the game would start, and they would merely send, let's say, Smith up. And then over would come B1L, that's ball one low. S1C, strike one call. And in fact, they didn't even send a call strike or a swinging strike or a foul strike in those days. I was one of the ones that raised so much cane. I said, for goodness sake, tell us what kind of strike it is. And we would stand in the studio and we would recreate these out-of-town ball games. And then Western Union, let's say Smith would have a ball and a strike, and then it would the pilot word would come hit. And then would come single, line drive, right center. Well, so he single line. It's up to you to remember who was out there in right center field, picked up the ball and threw it in, and you had to guess, well, you certainly threw it to the second baseman because you don't throw behind the runner.
Men, Strangler Lewis, the famous wrestler, gives you his opinion of Roy Tann cigars. Strangler Lewis.
Judge, I like Roy Tann because it has more long filler Havana tobacco, yet it is a 5-cent cigar. Man to man, smoke Roy Tann.
You're bored when other folks recite the cute things Junior said last night, but your kid's cute remarks are right. There's something about them you like.
Do ordinary cigarettes bore you? Try Herbert Terryton's, now 15 cents. There's something about them you like.
You know, I can't begin to mention all the great baseball reporting stories of the last 30 years, but real sports buffs will remember Rosie Rosewell, who covered the Pittsburgh Pirates for a couple of generations. This particular affair happened in 1948 in Pittsburgh, and the teller is Bob Prince, who covers the Pirates today.
Rosie was the fellow that, if you knew his expressions, and they certainly did in Pittsburgh, they loved him very much. He was sort of the Edgar Guest of the baseball. Get up there, Aunt Minnie, raise the window, and the old dipsy doodle, and get up and put a handkerchief on his head. Of course, I had to stand up there with a tray full of cowbells and glass and everything, and he'd blow the whistle, and he'd say, get up there, Aunt Minnie, and raise the window, and he'd blow the whistle, and he'd nod his head, and I'd drop the tray full of bologna, and all the debris go all over the studio, and then that sounded like breaking glass, and then he said, she never made it. Tripped over the garden hose. She never made it. A round tripper for Ralph Kane. Well, that led me into the funniest experience. Bing Crosby comes to town, and Doyle Lade is pitching for the Chicago Cubs. And Kiner hit one of the doggonest Doc Walloping shots off Doyle Lade up over the left field scoreboard in Forbes Field, a drive of about 450 feet. And Bing's looking out to the left field, and he's describing it, and I start to laugh. He looked at me, and I said, you haven't had a microphone since Kiner swung. And says, get up there, Aunt Minnie, and raise the window. Why don't we listen to it?
I was facing Doyle Lade now. Maybe do a little better. Any day.
There goes one. You don't need to raise the window, Aunt Minnie. There it goes clear out over the scoreboard. Over into Shenley Park, a round tripper for Ralph Kiner, his first of the 1948 season.
Oh, did he?
Let's hope that it's the first of 61. Oh. I just had to take that.
And then there was a time, also in Pittsburgh, when some old-timer mistook the broadcast booth for the men's room. Bob Prince was on the air.
This offer may vary in some states, but Red Ball dealer service never varies. Yes, sir, you get that Red Ball station, and remember to thank... It sounds like one of the political conventions going on in this booth.
You don't have to go deep to know what you should do when you are thirsty. Call for Hoffman, drink Hoffman. Hoffman is the finest when you're thirsty.
Brackety brick, brickety brack, Hoffman cherry leads the pack.
Hippity hop, hoppity hip, Hoffman lemon's got the zip.
Extra dry, extra pale, Hoffman finer ginger ale. Killa, Della, from Manila, Hoffman finer sarsaparilla.
You don't have to go to university to know what you should do when you are thirsty. Go for Hoffman, drink Hoffman. Hoffman is the finest when you're thirsty.
Given to Don Dahl, the left halfback, cracking off his own right tackle and goes 2 yards to the 35-yard line, is brought down by George Strohmeyer, backing up the left side of the Notre Dame line, assisted by Johnny Lujak and also Bob Scoglin, those three. And so a 2-yard gain makes it Southern California's ball.
This is Ted Husing's coverage of the 1946 game. Ted made his name in football, and doing play-by-play from a steamy booth looking directly into the afternoon sun was very tough. So Ted Husing leaned heavily on a spotter, and that spotter worked with him for a decade. He is Les Quayle.
He had to have somebody looking through binoculars all the time. See, Ted couldn't do that. He had to look with the naked eye. He had to take encompass the whole field, see what's going on left and right. But I could stay closed in on the ball carriers and who's doing the blocking and who made the tackles, and that's how he got the information. We did games where the teams were numbered on the back only. Today, they're numbered on the front, the back, the shoulders, the helmets, the heels of the shoes, through 29, 30, all the way through to 1935. We had these problems everywhere. They put the markers down every 10 yards, and they were all 1 foot square. Very little down the middle of the field, so you could pick up a runner there without looking to the sidelines to see what yard line he was in. We got them to put diamonds on the 20-yard lines, crosses on the 40, and in the case of Syracuse, they used their block S on the 50. So that if you saw a fellow pick up the ball, we'll say on the 22, you could see that diamond there. You didn't have to look to the sideline.
And now over to Bill Stern, standing by at the Madison Square Garden International Track Meet, where the mile run has just got underway.
Cunningham has gone back into the lead. Glenn Cunningham in first place with three quarters of a lap to go. Fenske is coming up to challenge. Still Cunningham out in front by a yard over Fenske. Here comes San Romani making his bid. It's Cunningham coming off the turn. Cunningham in first place. Fenske in second place. San Romani in third place, but San Romani's being nosed out. Cunningham wins the race. Fenske is in second.
In the name of the President of the United States, I proclaim open the Olympic Games of Los Angeles, celebrating the 10th Olympiad of the modern era.
Verkünde die Spiele von Berlin zur Feier der 11. Olympiade neuer Zeitrechnung als eröffnet.
The Olympic Games of 1936 in Berlin were absolutely brilliant from the sports angle. One man, just one man, sort of stole the show. He was a black American track star, Jesse Owens, winner of several gold medals. Naturally, the moment he left the stadium, the reporters were waiting for him.
Very glad to have won my three events in the Games here at Berlin. It's been the first time since 1924, about 12 years ago, and I'm very proud to have won. Wonderful competition here, a wonderful stadium, and a wonderful crowd, and the days have been very nice. And the people here in Germany have been very nice to me, and I'm very glad to display my talent here.
In those days, people were thrilled to hear that kind of broadcast live from Berlin, 4,000 miles away. But few of the shortwave pickups from Berlin in the next few years were as innocent as that one. Radio also covered tennis, racing, soapbox derbies, wrestling, hockey, and track. To cover a very fast-moving sport, you had to develop a machine gun style. This is Marty Glickman, and his specialty was and is basketball.
I worked on broadcasting basketball and developed a technique which is generally used in broadcasting basketball today. And the technique has to do with following the ball. I would set up a geography of the court, a fairly fundamental, simple thing to do. The court with the mid-court line and the corners and the foul circle and the foul line and the backcourt and the forecourt. And I would describe the movement of the ball as it went from one portion of the floor to the other portion of the floor, and that which impelled the ball to go there. A bounce pass into the right corner could be seen orally. A high arcing one-handed shot could be seen as it went through the air. A jump shot from the head of the foul circle. You knew exactly where the head of the foul circle was. You could see it in your mind's eye. Or he hooked a right-hander, or he popped a one-hander, or he had a spinning fall-away jump shot. Using the phraseology and the terminology of the basketball players themselves to describe, to mentally create this visual impression of what was taking place on the floor.
I suppose Clem McCarthy was best known for reporting the ponies, but he was no slouch at a fight. What mere newspaper account could equal the excitement of that gravelly voice and the aftermath when he jumped right into the ring? This is the first Lewis Smalling fight in 1936.
Shaking his head. The count is done. The fight is over. The fight is over. Aaron Smalling is the winner. Lewis is completely out. They've had to lift him and carry him to his corner.
Winner is Smalling!
Here comes Smalling over. Here comes Smalling over to our microphone. Clem McCarthy's jumped up to the ring. Max is now
congratulations,
down.
Max. Congratulations, my boy.
Oh, there you son. Yes, this is the heaviest day of my life. And I still think you, Lewis, is a very, very great prospect. Thanks very much.
How early, Max? How early did you think you'd win? How early?
Well, I had a hundred in the fourth round, you know.
In the fourth round, you had a good hunch?
Few rounds.
Huh? And Joe Jacobs, when did you think he'd win?
From the beginning, never thought he was going to lose.
Thank you, Joe Jacobs.
The second fight, 2 years later, lasted less than 2 minutes, and even Clem McCarthy ran out of words for a second or two.
Smalling is down. The count is 5, 5, 6, 7, 8. The men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Smalling is beaten in one round. The first time that a world heavyweight championship ever changed hands in one round. Ed Ferguson, I want you to have a chance on this broadcast. Everything will shut you out. Get in here and describe that scene. I'm going up to the ring to get the winner. Ed.
Everybody has been taken by surprise here. The ring is all this bewilderment all around. And here is Clem McCarthy.
You said it'd take you two rounds. You know how long it took you?
No, I don't exactly.
I imagine about a minute and a half.
Well, that's fine. Well, I won't be getting mad for less than a round.
Joe, which punch, if any, do you think was the one that started him downhill?
I think the right hand to the ribs.
Going in there, Joe, and she looked terrible. Congratulations.
I would have never been no more good if Joe hadn't got this second turn with Smalling.
That was Jack Blackburn, the man who has made Joe Lewis the champion of the world. Max, come over here. Bring him over. Max. He came to very quickly, but he was a badly beaten man, and it was all Lewis. And here is the distinction of the world's fastest broadcast on a fight. This was faster than Joe Lewis and Charlie Rett's lab. And now I turn you back to Ed Ferguson because he's had a great chance.
Well, it's all over, but the congratulations. We return you now to the NBC studios.
...10 p.m. BULOVA Bulova watch time. Wear a smart, dependable Bulova watch. The 17-jewel Bulova Patricia, only $24.75. WEAS, New York.
Won't you wait till the cows come home? Won't you wait till the cows come home? We're all contented, Bell and Boss. Soon the meadow they will cross. Down the lane at the close of day. Once again they will wend their way. Hear them in the dell. Contented you can tell. Won't you wait by the old red gate? Won't you wait till the cows come home?
The Carnation Contented Hour, now in its 12th year, presented every Monday for irradiated Carnation milk. The evaporated milk that is used
that
by...
That kind of formal radio show was incredibly popular during the 30s. Shows like that and the Telephone Hour and the City Service Hour did introduce people to classical music and operetta. And the networks could call on superb talent. The great Arturo Toscanini conducted for NBC. So did Walter Damrosch. CBS had Howard Barlow, Donald Voorhees, and many more. I recall the musical commentators, so to speak, Deems Taylor, Milton Cross, and Boris Goldowski on the Saturday afternoon opera. Remember this one?
I look upon each lovely bloom that cools the breezes with its faint perfume. And yet it seems my garden was not so fair. I know it's just because
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is my privilege and great pleasure to present the 10th anniversary program of The Voice of Firestone.
That was the black tie era of radio. People who literally didn't have the price of a movie ticket could sit home and attend a Broadway show on radio or even a musical. Tap dancing, for instance, was great on radio. And this is one of the best, Eleanor Powell. In 1936, people were thrilled to sit home and hear a radio version of the eye-filling Ziegfeld Follies. It's minutes before curtain time, but we still have a moment to spend with our stars in their dressing rooms, Fanny Bryce and James Melton.
Who is it?
Tell Miss Bryce it's me, James Melton.
Oh, come in, Jimmy. Sit down a minute, Jimmy.
Hey, I'm all excited.
So am I, and scared.
I always get shivers up and down my spine before an opening night.
And tonight is more than just an opening night. Think of it, Jimmy. We're bringing the Ziegfeld Follies to every corner of the United States.
It's just got to be good.
You bet it has.
But what are all those telegrams on the table?
Wires. Wires from all over the United States, Jimmy. Look, here's one from Billy Burke.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be listening into the Follies here in my Hollywood home, just as if I were there. Stop. Tom Olive is to be congratulated. Good luck.
Here's one from W.C. Fields. Thrilled to hear Flo Ziegfeld Follies is being broadcast. I'll be with you by radio.
And look at this one from Harold Miller. I'll be with you as of old, though I'm thousands of miles away. Good luck.
Here's one from Ruth Etting.
And another from Leon.
And one from Gladys Glad.
Could the show live up to the opening? Telegram, I doubt telegram, it. Telegram. Remember First Nighter?
The makers of Campana products present the First Nighter program. A copyrighted feature, Coast to Coast. Theater time and a new play scheduled for the little theater off Times Square. An opening night on the Great White Way is the kind of gala event that never fails to attract people from far and near. So let's get started early. We want to be in our seats on time. Now here's my cab. All right, driver, up Broadway.
And then there was the Maxwell House Showboat. The star and leading man for 20 years was tenor Lanny Ross.
Well, I can hear a whistle, Mary. You know, I've been talking about you and your junior review all week long.
Here she comes, Mr. Rossner.
Right time, Mary. Right into Little Rock, Arkansas. Flag flying, band playing, and the whole population on hand to go aboard when Lanny Ross presents the 225th performance.
Here comes the showboat. Here comes the showboat.
It was based on Edna Ferber's novel. It is a play within a play. You lived on the showboat with Captain Andy and his wife and his daughter, Mary Lou. I was the leading man, Ravenel, only I used my own name, Lanny Ross. Then, within the showboat, apart from its daily life, we had a show going on every night. People believed in our showboats and its life so much that when we'd announce it, well, the captain would say, well, folks, it's been great to have you on board. Now, next week, we're going to go up to Erie, Pennsylvania, and we'll be there at 9 o'clock, sure shooting. Till then, everybody, it's just your loyalty to Maxwell House coffee and so on and so on and so on. The next week in Erie, Pennsylvania, people came down in their motor cars with their radios on, peering out the windshield to see where the showboat was going to be. And 9 o'clock came, and there was no showboat, except they heard on the radio, well, welcome to the folk mayor of Erie. How are you, Mayor O'Schlafferty, or whatever his name is? It's great. You have a lovely evening up here. And they all look around, where is this showboat that they're talking about? Now, do you think that that's a test of people's belief in the integrity of the showboat?
My love, good night, my love, the man.